Broward prosecutors released three videos made by the Parkland shooter. How could they impact the prosecution's case for a death penalty? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The videos are chilling. In it, the shooter boasts about how many people he wants to kill and how this one act will make him famous. Some Stoneman Douglas students don't want the media to play the videos and mention the shooter's name. How should the media cover these sorts of stories? Are we helping these folks gain the fame they desperately seek? Plus, we know thousands of Puerto Ricans have left the island for the mainland after last year's hurricanes, but we spoke with a data firm who tracked, using cell phone data, exactly where those people migrated to.
We saw around 12% of the total population of Puerto Rico and of leaving the island and heading to the U.S.
And it's time again for the summer shorts put on by City Theater. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, yesterday, the Broward State Attorney's Office released a series of videos created by confessed Parkland shooter Nicholas Cruz. These are disturbing confessional videos. He talks about going to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High with an AR-15. In one video, he said he would kill at least 20 people. Now, the videos were released as part of the prosecution of the confessed shooter. In one, the shooter does say, quote, "When you see me on the news, you'll know who I am," end quote. WLRN has decided not to play any of the recordings of these videos. Now, why we're not going to play, while we won't play the audio, we will describe what's in the videos. We're joined now by Miami Herald reporters Nicholas Nehemas and David Ovalle. Nicholas and David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
What new information did we gather from these videos? David, let me start with you.
Well, the prosecution didn't need a whole lot more in terms of premeditation for a first-degree murder. I think just legally speaking, him entering and shooting up the place and killing 17 people certainly is more than enough to prove premeditation. But those videos, once the investigators downloaded them and were able to look at them, certainly is the proverbial icing on the cake in terms of premeditation in proving first-degree murder. So that's sort of, you know, the fact that he methodically laid it out, that he even described how he was going to get there, certainly would destroy any defense of this was a spur of the moment, sort of last minute type of thing. But I think that's probably the main takeaway in what those videos would prove if this case were ever to go to a trial.
And Nick, you know, let's talk about the videos. As I mentioned, we're not going to play any of the audio, but we will describe some of what was in them. I mean, there was more than one video.
There were three videos, all short, less than 90 seconds. One of them, it was suggested by Cruz on the tape that he planned to attack the school that same day. And, you know, another aspect that's important here is this is our first potential insight into what may have motivated this horrible attack. And, you know, from the videos, you see an angry, delusional, disturbed young man who, you know, felt disaffected for whatever reason and decided to take out his anger with violence.
And does anything in the video tell us what the motivation was, or is it just him rambling on about what he wants to do?
Well, it seems that he was angry at his classmates, who he said, you know, or his former classmates, who he said considered him an idiot, when in fact, you know, they were the idiots and had been brainwashed by some kind of vague political program. He wasn't specific about, you know, really this seems to been about his desire for power and recognition and revenge. He also mentions a girl that he was in love with who apparently did not love him back. So, you know, it really is a rather twisted, rambling series of monologues.
David, why did the prosecution release these now?
Well, the prosecution released these videos as part of what's called the discovery process. So once a majority of the evidence is made available to the defense team, it is also made available to the public and, of course, to the media. Now, there are exemptions. Certain types of substance of confession, for example, is not generally allowed to be released because it may prejudice a jury down the road. The prosecutors obviously determined that this didn't fall under that exemption because it's sort of a pre-planning type of thing. It might have been a exemption to a conspiracy count, let's say, but if in a different type of circumstance. But in this case, they, you know, he's not saying I did it, so this is before it actually happened. So there's a lot of different exemptions, but generally, most evidence in Florida is considered public record, and so therefore is allowed to be released to the media. So this was released as part of media requests, not just by the Miami Herald, but by multiple media outlets.
And you kind of you sort of touched on it. I mean, we're talking about what the prosecution's case here. I mean, does the video like this pretty much secure a death penalty?
No. It does not, because there's two separate phases. So the first phase would be a guilt phase, or whether he, you know, was guilty of doing this. I think that's pretty much a foregone conclusion. I mean, even Cruz's defense has indicated that they're not really going to contest the guilt phase of it. I mean, even if you tried to go insanity, you couldn't, you know, that he didn't know right from wrong when he did this would be shattered by the simple methodical nature of the attack, and just how much thought went into the planning of it. And certainly the videos would eviscerate that type of defense. But still, the main thing for the defense is they want to keep Nicholas Cruz off death row. And that's going to be a huge mitigation package that they have to try to present to a jury as to whether to spare his life. So they're going to, you know, that's separate and apart from this is what went into him feeling this way. And this is his long history of troubling behavior and a system that let him down. And all it takes is one juror. Now in Florida, it has to be a unanimous jury. And so you can see how, for example, in the Aurora shooting, the movie theater shooting in Colorado, they could not get a unanimous jury to agree on the death penalty. So certainly they have a lot to work with in this case, and their main goal is to keep Nicholas Cruz alive.
Nick, has the school district, the Broward County School District, commented? Has any school district commented on the release of these videos?
Not that I've seen. No, there's been no comment, and the public defender declined to comment as well on these tapes.
Now, you know, we've talked about warning signs that, you know, people have said there were warning signs with the shooter. And there's always hindsight. After every shooting, there were warning signs. But what do we know about how school districts are dealing with supposed warning signs? Are they watching kids more carefully, watching their social media more carefully? Are they looking for the next potential, issue?
It seems like schools have been more aware from what I've seen. And, you know, David has covered these cases and, you know, maybe can talk about whether there's an uptick in cases of, you know, threats where there's an arrest made, or if we're just noticing them more.
I mean, David, have you heard of that?
Yes, I think there's definitely been an uptick there. I mean, just this last week, I think there was media coverage of some threats to Coral Gables High and a few other schools. So they're definitely the police monitoring the schools are definitely more sensitive to these types of threats, because exactly what happened with Cruz is he had made a lot of these threats and they kind of just went off into the ether and nobody seemed to take them very seriously. You know, I know there's a debate over whether media outlets should play the audio, play the video, and certainly there are legitimate reasons on both sides. But you know, one reason to play some of these videos is that maybe it jars somebody, and somebody says, "Hey, this reminds me of such and such student or someone that I know that is exhibiting these similar types of behaviors." So, I think certainly authorities in the school districts are very, very cognizant of that, and they're that much more sensitive to these.
And
these types of red flags.
Interesting you bring that up. So one of the parents of the victims, Fred Gutenberg, said that he's worried that the media coverage would inspire future shooters. And as you said, news media companies have to discuss how they're going to cover this sort of story. And Nick, let me start with you. I mean, what's the Miami Herald's take on this? I mean, obviously you posted the videos. You know, is there ever a discussion about should we mention this shooter by name? Should we put the videos up or not? I mean, how do you handle that?
Yeah, that's something, you know, we talk about very carefully. But I think one of the biggest arguments for posting these videos is one David just laid out, that, you know, these videos are disturbing. I encourage everyone to make up their own mind about whether they want to watch them. But, you know, if you do watch them and it reminds you of someone or someone's odd behavior, because, you know, his behavior in these videos is distinctive and odd and clearly very troubled. And, you know, the Herald did feel that there was a public service in publishing these videos. I know some news organizations, you know, are worried about inspiring copycats and just chose to publish the transcripts. But, you know, we discussed it. And, you know, if someone wants to read the transcript, there's not much of a difference between that and watching a video. You know, Nicholas Cruz is certainly notorious at this point, and that is something he wanted. But, you know, this is evidence that's going to be presented in a possible death penalty trial and used potentially to put a citizen to death. And, you know, we felt it's in the public's interest to have all this information. Journalists are not censors.
And I wondered, what sort of response have you heard from your readers? How do they feel about the release of all this information?
There are certainly some who feel that, you know, it was inappropriate, and they've asked us not to name the shooter or show any pictures of the shooter ever under any circumstances. There are some who thought we would have been best served just to publish a transcript, and there are some who think that this is really newsworthy, important information. You know, let's not forget that the Parkland shooting is going to be chronicled in American history books, most likely, as something that really changed the political discourse around guns in this nation. And I think it's
Let me wrap up on this, and I want to hear from both of you on it, though. One of the things that the shooter again said in the video is that, quote, "And when you see me on the news, you'll know who I am." Yes, all of the things that you've said, that it's public information, this is part of a trial, and maybe watching the videos, we learn something about his behavior if we see it in somebody else, that it's a public service. But in any way, are we helping him and people like him achieve that fame that he wanted?
I think it's a difficult question to answer, because there's no right or wrong answer. And the media landscape is such that we are bombarded with these images and these videos from the second even the shooting happened. I mean, the second, for example, the shooting was unfolding, and within, you know, minutes, we were getting Snapchats and Instagrams and tweets from people inside. And from the very, very get-go, you know, this person is becoming notorious, whether we're here or not. So I think for us, and again, like I said, there's no right or wrong answer, but I think we need to just try to frame it in the best way possible to try to explain our reasoning. And look, you're going to have people that say we shouldn't do anything, and you're going to have people that say we should do everything. There's no right or wrong answer, but I think as long as we try to frame it and explain why our rationale for publishing these videos and these images and even his name, I think it's something that we need to continue to do.
And Nick, real quickly, in 30 seconds.
Yeah, no, I think David's absolutely right. I mean, at a certain point, you know, do you not cover his trial, because that gives him the notoriety he seeks? I mean, we have a much wider responsibility. And, you know, I just end with what Fred Gutenberg, a parent, a father of a victim we spoke to, said. You know, what people need to remember about this kid is, and what everyone who's might be inspired by him needs to remember, is he is going to rot and die in jail. And that's the message that people should take away from his case.
We've been talking with Miami Herald reporters Nick Nehemas and David Ovalle as they have covered this story. Again, the videos released by the Parkland shooter by the Broward County state attorney, but it was produced by the Parkland shooter. And we do have a link to their story, by the way, on our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. Nick, David, thank you so much. I appreciate the time, man.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, I want to turn things over now to Dr. Peter Langman. He's the author of a book called School Shooters, Understanding High School, College, and Adult Perpetrators, and he joins us now via Skype. He also runs a database called schoolshooters.info. Dr. Langman, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And again, he's joining us via Skype. You watched the videos. I mean, what do they tell us about the shooter?
Well, like a number of other shooters, this perpetrator seemed to be focused on what we call self-enhancement and fame-seeking through violence. He clearly wanted to be known. Part of his motivation, at least, was to make a name for himself, to make his mark in the world, as they say. So in some ways, he resembles other shooters. So not every shooter has that motivation, but we have certainly seen that behavior before.
Are they just copycatting each other? Are they just looking at the last guy? Because one of the things this shooter said is, I'm going to be one of the 2018 school shooters. Are they just copycatting each other?
You know, often there is some reference to a previous shooter. So whether you call it copycat, perhaps role modeling, some kind of influence, sometimes it's a matter of wanting to outdo previous shooters to make a bigger name for themselves by killing more people. So, you know, knowing about one shooter doesn't cause someone to become a shooter, but we certainly see that reference back to previous shooters in many cases.
You've examined dozens of others of these shooters. What are the common threads that we see about their psychological behaviors and tendencies?
Well, you know, there's a wide range of shooters who commit different types of attack. And I think the fundamental assumption many people make is that we can talk about them as if they're all the same. And there are some shooters who target specific individuals they have a grievance against, but there are also those shooters who target random people, no specific victims in mind, who just want to kill for the sake of killing as many as possible and making a name for themselves. So the motivation across these different types of attacks can vary. The most common thing we see, though, is some level of rage. The reason for the rage may differ, but underlying many of these attacks is this sense of incredible anger and often a sense of injustice that they've been dealt a raw deal in life or that they've suffered unfairly.
And maybe you heard from my previous conversation, but when we're talking about the role the media plays in this, one of the things that we heard from one of the Miami Herald reporters is that, you know, we have to post this information and perhaps watching these videos, we might learn something. Is the behavior from these shooters something that we could spot and maybe stop the next one?
Well, certainly there's often warning signs, and it's not only that in hindsight, it's easier to see them. That certainly is true. But many times the warning signs are very blatant. For example, in this case, the perpetrator said he's going to be a school shooter. He even posted something online about being the next school shooter. Unfortunately, when the warning signs are that obvious, people may think they're not really true, that the person is just engaging in some big talk, bragging about something, and you don't have to take it seriously. Often the warning signs are very clear. People talk about, I'm going to get a gun and come to school and shoot people. But if they're very young, that may be dismissed as something they couldn't possibly do. If people know the perpetrator or are friends with him, they might think he could never do it. So the warning signs are often there, and what's important is that people take them seriously and report them.
And Dr. Langman, are teachers and counselors trained to spot some of those other signs, not the obvious ones, but all of them?
You know, my impression is the focus on school safety for many years now has been on emergency response, lockdown procedures, how to survive an active shooting, and so on. And much less on recognizing the warning signs and knowing how to investigate and evaluate the threats that are brought to light. So I think as a nation, we have a long way to go to educating both the staff and the students in our schools about the warning signs and what to do when you see them.
The other question I had, too, for the other two reporters, I'd love your take, is really how the news media handles these sorts of stories. Is there a way we should be approaching this?
You know, my preference is to focus less on the perpetrator and more on the victims. Of course, the story has to be covered. The court case has to be covered in the media. But that doesn't mean we have to put photos and videos of the perpetrator, you know, on the front pages, on the websites. We don't have to give them the recognition that in some cases they're looking for. So, you know, my preference would be that the videos be covered in terms of providing quotes or transcripts rather than giving him that form to have the videos themselves aired publicly.
Let me wrap up with this. There are future videos to be released. What information are you hoping to discern from those in order to learn more about this shooter?
Now, I'd like to try to get more of a sense of his history, the factors that put him on the path of violence, the motivation for this act, you know, his personality characteristics. There's still so much that we don't really know about this perpetrator.
Again, we are talking with Dr. Peter Langman, author of the book School Shooters, Understanding High School, College, and Adult Perpetrators. He joined us via Skype. Dr. Langman, I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans have migrated from the island to the U.S. mainland after the hurricanes. Now we have data that show us exactly where they went. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, although the official death toll remains at 64, there's a study that puts the death toll in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria at 4,600, with disruptions in Medicare, electricity, and infrastructure damage being one of the primary causes. In the months following Hurricane Irma, thousands of Puerto Ricans left the deteriorating conditions of the island for refuge in the mainland United States. The company Teralytics was able to analyze cell phone location data for hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans and developed a sophisticated map of migration patterns. Now, you can see a map of the migration on both our Facebook and Twitter pages. Just look up WLRN Sundial. South Florida was among the primary destinations for many of these travelers. More than 15,000 came to Miami-Dade County and 10,000 to Broward County. Alistair McLeod is the CEO for Teralytics, and he talked to us from the NPR studios in New York City to talk about the data and the potential future applications for it. And I started by asking how they even gathered the data.
We build our insights using telecom data, so data ingested from the masts of a telecom network. The data we use is, before we touch it, it's anonymized and it's randomized and all the personal information is stripped away. And we also aggregate it into blocks so that even the anonymized private data doesn't represent individuals, it identifies groups. But what's precious about the data, we call it inclusive data, because for cases like this, what matters is that you are looking at everybody, or you're looking at a highly representative sample of the population. And what's so great about the telecom data that we use is all you have to be doing is holding a phone, and the phone has to be turned on, and you become kind of a sample point. We never go anywhere near the sort of, as I said, the individual data, but by the time you aggregate that up to tens or hundreds of thousands of people, you're seeing a highly representative sample of the population. And then because the data is so precise, we can then go one step further and do a process we call extrapolation to take that from the sample we see, which might be, say, 15% of the population. We can make that into a very accurate representation of the whole population.
And so, you talk about
it all comes from telecom.
You talk about all data, all people. Is that all cell phone data or just smartphones?
No, absolutely. It's all cell phones all the time. And I mean, our company was built by two very smart guys who are educated in Switzerland, on the basis that this data can be used to change the world for the better. I mean, they're very, you know, they genuinely have a belief that this can be good for society. And in order to do that, the data has to be inclusive. It has to represent everybody, at least as far as humanly possible. So our data doesn't care whether you're carrying a $1,200 smartphone or whether you're carrying an old Mars bar phone from 10 years ago. So long as it's on and it's talking to the network, that's good. And that's one of a number of ways that means that our data, you know, takes away the bias for wealth or social class, or, you know, these days pretty much everybody has a phone of some kind, even if it's an old cheap phone, and it doesn't matter. As long as you've got a phone in your pocket and it's turned on, then you're in our sample.
So that helps
us to be inclusive.
Let's look at the raw numbers. How many people did we see, or what percentage of folks did we see migrating from Puerto Rico to the mainland in the months after Hurricane Irma?
In total, over that period, we saw around 12% of the total population of Puerto Rico and of leaving the island and heading to the U.S. And out of that 12%, roughly 6% have stayed away, still live in the U.S., and 6% left but had returned by February of this year.
So Florida saw among the largest number of migrants, including tens of thousands in Broward and Dade County. Do we have a sense of how long people stayed in Florida?
In Florida, not particularly. What we did see, which is, I mean, we tracked the data at the top level, so we tracked the people that migrated from Puerto Rico to the United States, and then the patterns of the people that track back. What we do know is that the tracking back, like the migration back to Puerto Rico, started really in significant numbers in November following the hurricane, and January of this year, January 2018, was the first month where there was a sort of a net migration back to Puerto Rico. In other words, more people returning from the U.S. than leaving to go to the U.S.
Alistair, explain the mission behind Terralytics and your primary focus.
Mission behind Terralytics at the highest level is to use this data to improve the lives of people, in predominantly in terms of giving them more time back. So we're all about human mobility. Our main focus is transportation and mobility as it moves into these new modes with, you know, traditional operators, you know, having to rethink how they serve people well, you know, disruptors like Uber and Lyft and, you know, coming into the market and offering new modes of transport, and cities, public bodies all having to rethink how they can serve the citizens better.
Can you give me an example of a project, a large-scale project that you've been involved in that can help us relate to this, you know, what you're looking at when it comes to public transit, climate change, et cetera?
We worked on a large project elsewhere in the world, which is serving an organization that's kind of the local equivalent of the New York Transit System, the New York MTA. And there what we do is we provide operational data that lets them run the transit system more effectively. And that means everything from at the strategic planning end, how far away are people's homes from the first node of the transit network? In other words, how long does it take to get onto the system in the first place, or how long does it take to get off to your work? If those times are too long, then it means the transit system isn't serving the population very well. So we provide data for that. But then in real time, we're also providing them with data like how full are the trains? Are the trains running on time? Are the platforms so busy and the trains so busy that people can't board? So from that client's point of view, it's all about they are tasked by their citizens with running a highly effective transit network in order that people have access to social, have access to economic opportunity. The better they run the network, the easier it is for people to get to work, earn money, and still have a work-life balance. And we provide them with a machine learning-powered desktop that gives them kind of like a console to run their network in an extremely efficient way.
We're talking with Alistair McLeod, CEO of Terralytics. This is a company that collects data and then helps us understand that data. They recently analyzed cell phone location data for hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans who migrated from the island to the mainland in the months after Hurricane Irma. They developed a sophisticated map of migration patterns of Puerto Ricans. And he's joining us now from the NPR studios in New York City. Alistair, what caused you to generate this project surrounding the Puerto Rico migration data? I mean, were you hired by a nonprofit or a government agency?
Not at all, Lewis. No, our main focus is because we focus on human mobility, our business interest is transportation and mobility and how we can help those operators run their businesses better, how we can help cities to be more efficient in terms of getting people around. But we're constantly on the lookout for, you know, what we call, or you might call, social good cases, because the founders, you know, started the company in the belief that this data can be great for society. And whilst, you know, improving cities is great for society and helping mobility operators is also great for society, we've always on the lookout for these sort of social good cases where the data can be put to good use that isn't necessarily all about sort of commercial gain in these cases.
And what have you heard? I'm curious, what have you heard from whether private companies or individuals or even governments about this particular data of Puerto Rican migration?
A Puerto Rico study appeared in online with a media publication, and it generated a lot of inbound interest, that's for sure. It also generated some interest from emergency management agencies. A couple of those have contacted us, and we'll start that conversation to see whether it can be of use. It's not our core business. We don't have a ready-made case that says, hey, here's the solution you guys are looking for to manage disasters more effectively. But if the data can be put to that use, and let's say, for example, more lives could be saved the next time there's a hurricane, or more people can be moved to safety more effectively the next time there's a wildfire in California, then, you know, obviously those are cases that we'd love to help with.
When people hear about cell phone location data being tracked, there's an immediate concern of privacy. But look, as a consumer, can Terralytics track my location? Is it something I should worry about?
No, we can't. We can't and we don't. I mean, firstly, the whole company is built on, you know, a strong code of ethics and a total lack of interest in individual mobility. We don't track individuals. We don't target individuals. Our interest is in helping large groups of people and populations. So before we even touch the data, it's been grouped into blocks. It's been, you know, everybody, all the identifiable information like numbers have been taken off. It's random dots as far as we're concerned. And we group those dots into groups of at least 25 so that even though it's completely anonymous, it's also grouped together as a block of 25 or more. Sometimes it can be a block of 1,000. our interest is, you know, how did the population move around, or how did 10,000 people that live in this district get to work today?
You mentioned earlier New York's public transportation system and collecting data that helps understand how that can work more efficiently. So recently we had a conversation on our program about buses in Miami-Dade County failing to show up on time or even missing routes, and of course a decline in our ridership. How would this data help this community better design our public transportation system?
Interesting. And we've actually done some work elsewhere in the United States with buses. There's quite a lot of regulations if cities or states want to change bus routes, because obviously there's a requirement that if you're going to make those changes, you're going to make changes that are in the interest of the population. So what you're referring to is what we call mobility demand is one part of it. And you're also referring to another thing we call kind of first mile and last mile. So in order for the bus network to serve the citizens well, a couple of things have to be true. One is the bus stops have got to be placed in such a way that it doesn't take you too long to get there. Otherwise, you won't bother. And secondly, that we have the bus routes in terms of capacity, frequency and so on have to be set up in such a way that it genuinely serves the citizens. And I think there are two ways in which we are helping customers now, and we'll help them in the future to improve bus services specifically. One is that by understanding those patterns of, you know, where people live and work versus where the network is, we can make sure that the network is optimized. And we do that a lot. That's what we call first mile, last mile. Where I think it's going to get super interesting, and we're starting to see these models emerge now, is we're moving from static routes to, you know, static routes where this is where the bus is and this is where it goes and it's got 50 seats and, you know, that's your lot, to mobility on demand, where buses all kind of become more like a bit of a large version of a ride-hailing service. You'll be able to sort of, if you were fortunate to own a smartphone, you'll be able to use your smartphone to say, hey, I'm here and I want to get picked up. That'll allow a totally different form of transport that's more personalized to you. More services will run when you actually need them. The reason we're keen to encourage people to work with us with this inclusive data is typically the people that have the greatest need for public transportation, you know, are also sort of somewhat overlapping with the people that have the, you know, have the greatest need to access new forms of kind of economic opportunity. So in other words, buses have to work for everybody, but particularly for the people who really need to get to work to earn a buck.
And that was Alistair McLeod, CEO of the company Teralytics, discussing the tracking of cell phone data for those that migrated from Puerto Rico to the United States mainland. You can see the map illustrating the migration data at our Facebook page and Twitter, again, WLRN Sundial. Still to come, it's time for another season of Summer Shorts. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A young man brings his fiancée home to meet his parents, who happen to be elves. An author experiencing a midlife crisis before his primetime performance. God, that's hitting home for me. A romantic evening gone awry when a cat enters the picture. These are three of the 10 short plays and musicals put together in a theatrical marathon known as Summer Shorts, put on by City Theater at the Arts Center. Now in its 23rd year, the production has become a mainstay for Miami audiences as an opportunity to see local playwrights and new pieces for the very first time. Susan Westfall is the artistic director for the City Theater and has been part of the Summer Shorts since the very beginning. Susan, great to have you.
Thank you very much.
So great to have you. Joining us also are the actors Tom Wall and Elizabeth Diamond, who've each performed in a dozen or so Summer Short productions. They're playing a variety of characters in this year's show, and you're going to hear next year, by the way, in just a little bit. But Tom, Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much. Great
Our
to
pleasure.
Be here.
All right. 8 plays, 2 musicals, all coming together in 2.5 weeks. Susan, that's really daunting. And, I've done a little theater back in the day. Doing one show is enough. Come on. That's a lot. How do you do it?
Well, we've been doing it for 23 years, so
you got good practice.
We do, and we have wonderful actors, and that's so much part of the success. And Tom and Beth have I don't even know, what do we say, 12 years each.
This is my 12th year
and my 11th.
Yeah,
I bow to Tom.
Veterans.
So I mean, they, you know, when you go into rehearsal, these guys are veterans of shorts, so they know really what the rhythm is and how to jump in. There would be that.
I want to ask you, let me start with this, and since everybody's been doing this now for some time, is how it's grown and changed. Like, take us back to the beginning. What was it like at the beginning?
Well, the very first year, when we decided to do this, nobody really knew what a 10-minute play was. There was that. That was a genre. And even I, you know, I'm a playwright. I sort of said, what can you do in 10 minutes? I wasn't sure. But what we were trying to think about, and these were my two partners at the time, Stephanie Norman and Elena Wall, was how can we cook up a company that is going to be embracing our communities? So the first thing was, let's do something in the summer, because all of these folks typically worked in a, at the time, what was a traditional season, so that, which would be what, October to April. So we were in the summer, and we were at the Ring Theater on the UM campus because it was available. So when we said hello to these 10-minute plays, we didn't know how to say no to these plays. So the first festival had 18 plays in it.
All right, so how do we, you know what I want, oh my gosh, okay, 18?
18 plays.
Ambitious. But no, well, first of all, I mean, for you, for actors, I mean, what was it like in those first, you know, those first few years when you have to embrace this idea? Because, yeah, as you said, you're used to doing, I mean, a short is 30 minutes, and that's a short. That's a one-act play.
Mm-hmm.
They're about 30 minutes. So now it's like, no, 10 minutes. I mean,
10 minutes.
How did everybody take it? Did everybody kind of embrace it, or did they have to get used to this?
Well, the audiences loved it right off the bat, and so did the critics, the very first one that we did. And it's, you know, we were looking into the future at short attention span theater. Mm-hmm. The thing that made the festival so interesting, though, was discovering what the versatility of a 10-minute play can mean, what the range of styles within this genre, and how an ensemble of 9 or 10 actors at that time and 8 directors could open these plays up and bring a season of productions into 2 hours.
All right. So, Elizabeth Tom, let me ask you this. How do you get me involved in 10 minutes? Storytelling 101. I need some time, get to know the characters. I got to invest in this. How are you doing this in 10 minutes?
Yeah, you just have to start right off the bat. I mean, from the first minute the lights come up, we have to be able to show you a fully realized play with fully realized and developed characters. It's the same process as with a full-length, you know, 2-hour play. We just have to do it a lot faster, you know, because like you said, you don't have that time to sort of ease into it and figure out who's who and what's happening. We've got to give it to you right away.
And the onus so much is on the playwright to do that. So they've written a play that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, just like an hour and a half play, but it's very succinct. But that's the joy of it. And I think with our audiences, they love seeing that. And if it's not completely in their what they find interesting, then they know the next one maybe, because it's coming around the bend, you know.
How much of it too is the fact that, you know, that look, we live in, when you guys started this 23 years ago, I mean, we didn't have YouTube, we didn't have a lot of social media, and now everything's quick videos, everything's right. A video everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they're quick, and we get everything in 5 minutes or less. That maybe audiences, their perception, their expectation is 10 minutes is too long, maybe give it to me in less. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, we've got a couple. I think one is 7.
It'll
appeal
do.
To them.
We
and
do.
it is great for a younger audience as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Susie, when you first started and we first started, you know, doing these 10-minute plays, I think MTV was just mm-hmm. really popular. And that, you know, who even knows what that is anymore?
Hey, I grew up with MTV.
Me
I loved
too.
My MTV. So, coming back to this, Elizabeth, in this you got 5 different characters you're playing
right.
in this production.
Right.
Okay, so as an actor, how do you approach that? That's lots of lines to memorize, and now you're jumping from one character to the next. How do you do this?
What I always say about that is it's like being back in school when you were in drama school and you were doing one scene study in one class and you were doing a Shakespearean scene study in another class, and then you went to the other class and did a monologue and you did your dialect work in another class. It's just jumping back and forth. And as people, you do that all day long with all the people that you know. You're different people with who you're with. It's not as complicated as, I don't know. I love it, so it's not complicated. But you have great costumes. I have... amazing costume.
So are you saying the costume changes are more difficult than the character
sometimes,
changes?
Sometimes. Oh, okay. There's one I have to do. I can't do it myself because I don't have any hands in it, in the play.
Well, what are you?
I'm a praying mantis.
A praying mantis. Okay. Interesting. All right. You know, there's a variety of shows this year, from stories, as I mentioned, a couple of them. You have stories about interracial marriage and faith, the praying mantis in The Office, to an elfish family meeting their son's fiance. Susan, explain, how do you select the shorts, the plays?
Well, it's like putting together, curating a box of chocolates. So you want to make sure that every taste is represented, or as much as possible. And taste changes. I mean, I will say that every year when the plays come in, we are looking at what writers are writing about. And
where are the plays coming from? Are they local?
The plays come from all over the country.
All over the
country. They come from our backyard. They come from the other side of the state. They come from playwrights all over the United States. We are the only theater in the United States that produces short plays and short musicals. We're it. The only one.
So you get a lot of people submitting ideas.
We do. And they're one. Well, we get people submitting plays, and the plays are what are so interesting. And I think our audience has become more sophisticated. So there is an expectation there that the storytelling's going to be really good. So this year, I think we did want to take a more comedic slant because it's summer and it's been, you know, a sometimes exhausting year and people want to be entertained. But I think there's an edge that goes into this season of plays that isn't overt, but it will make people laugh. It is. They're going to say, oh my God, I did that at my son's bris, for example.
Get a little foreshadowing, why not? Susan Westfall, again, is the artistic director for City Theater, and we're talking about the 23rd year now for City Theater at the Arts Center, putting on these summer shorts. We're also talking to Elizabeth Diamond and Tom Wall, two performers who are going to be doing multiple things in the show, because it's a lot of different shows. All right, so Beth and Tom, you're in a play about a couple clearing out their garage of their old belongings, and I wanted to get a little taste. Give the audience a little taste of what's going on. So set the scene for us here. What's happening?
Okay, the play is called Duck.
Duck.
By Sheila Cowley. And she is a Florida playwright.
Okay.
And I play the wife. She's in the garage. She's starting to clean out these boxes of stuff belonging to their her mom, his mom, you know, her uncle, how you accumulate all these things. And it's just a couple going through all that together.
All right, so no need for costume changes. You're all set. Scene is yours. Go for it.
You can't get rid of that.
Why not?
Because it's your mom's.
Well, so is this, and this, and that.
No, that's my mom's.
Is it?
It's from her salad days.
That's right.
My salad days?
You wish.
Well, I did have some coleslaw days.
I hope.
What are you doing?
Well, you just can't walk in here. You can't get one more thing stuffed into this damn garage. I'm sick of it.
But it's your mom's.
Well, God, just... what am I supposed to do with it?
With this?
Sure. That.
I don't know what it is.
Neither do I.
Oh, look, here's your granny's trophy. Geez, for archery?
And there you go. Can't throw it away. You can't give it away.
I'm trying to recall your salad days.
Well, maybe if I'm lucky, I just haven't had them yet.
Slow down.
No way. I am building up momentum. It's the only way to get through all this junk. And then we can get our bikes in here, not in the guest room like we're monkeys.
Well, but aren't you going to keep this?
Well, it's... I don't know. It doesn't matter.
No, it's nice.
It is, but where are we going to put it?
Well, you take it to your office.
I'm not taking my mom's monogram Sculling Club beer stein to the office.
But they won first place.
Oh, I mean, it's my mom's stuff and your mom's stuff. And my mom had her brother's stuff, her mother's stuff, and her mom had everyone else's stuff. It's all these thousand billion unlabeled photos of who knows. I mean, if only somebody had labeled stuff.
Again, we're listening to Elizabeth Diamond and Tom Wall, two performers. That's one of the shorts they're going to be putting on as part of the summer shorts put on by City Theater at the Arts Center, again in their 23rd year. If I understand correctly, there are no props. You don't have any props in this show.
In that particular
play.
In
that particular play.
Correct.
So what we heard is kind of what they're going to see. How do you do that, though, on stage when people are watching it?
Well, for us in rehearsal, we had boxes at first, cardboard boxes that we used that, you know, to stand in for whatever might be. And then we identified each object for ourselves, what it might be that we're picking up. And then eventually the day came where they removed all those boxes. And then it's just a blank floor. And we had to remember where we thought things were so you don't step over the things that you had imagined being there and had the audience imagine that are there. But what we found is that when we did perform it for other cast members, that they were able to remember their own things that they have and kind of use that memory to invest in what we have shown them. So,
I'd imagine just still a lot of hand movements, though,
yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
As you're trying to paint the picture for
right.
us.
Mm-hmm.
Susan, I was thinking about that these plays are rehearsed over a 2.5-week period and then performed over the next month. But, you know, again, I'm trying to figure out how you get everybody ready, you know, compared to doing a regular, whether it's a one-act play or a full play. And again, you have musicals, mm-hmm. which is more work. Mm-hmm. So how do you fit and cram all of that in there and get everybody prepared?
Well, actually, Margaret Ledford is the City Theater Artistic Director. I'm a co-founder and the Literary Director for City. It's Margaret's job to figure all of this out. And she is an amazing wrangler of art and talent. The directors, in fact, this year are an amazing group of people. But one of the things that has come up is this. When you're doing a full-length play, you really do, as actors and as playwrights, you have pages to kind of walk into and feel around and get the audience ready. Gail Garrison, who is one of our directors and was our founding artistic director, used to go into rehearsal and say, you know that first week, you guys, of where you were, like trying to figure out where you were? Okay, you got there, and now we just have to go. And that's what happens. We're all ready. We are on go now. The thing that will be interesting, and this is my favorite part, is opening night is opening night. And it's exciting, and everybody's remembering where they have to go and what costumes to put on and all the rest of that stuff. And the audiences are finally sitting in the house and giving the actors so much love and attention. They're finally, that's why they're there. But when you get to the last performance, and how you watch these guys cook, really cook over a month with this festival, as a playwright, I have to say that's my favorite thing.
You talk about audiences, and I wanted to know, who are the audiences for these shows? I mean, is there a theater-going audience they have an appetite for this, or it's, I mean, well, look, we're a tourist town, too. So is it tourists? I mean, who's coming to the shows? What do you see?
I think it's a mix of people. I think when we first started out, it was real theater goers that they were interested in the genre and it was something new. Now I see a younger bunch of people coming in, which is exciting. It's exciting to see young people in the theater because I personally want to keep working and I need to know that audience is going to be there. But it's a great date night. It's a wonderful date night. And they're interested in this. And they've been coming back now that they found it. They go, oh, this is fantastic. And it introduces them to other kind of theater.
If you tell them real quickly, in the short time we have, is like, no one's ever seen this. Each of you describe briefly, what do you think they're going to take away from it? Elizabeth, let me start with you real quickly. I'll go around the table.
For me, there was a theme going from at least the plays that I'm in, a real feeling of acceptance, that we have to accept what is before we can change it. And for me, that's been a theme.
Tom, what about you?
I think a lot of people will leave saying, wow, that was just such a fun night of theater. Just fun. And we used to say, well, if there's a particular play you didn't like, in 10 minutes, it's over. And you're on to the next one. So it's just a lot of fun.
And Susan?
Well, I think the musicals are so terrific this year. And for people who love plays, they have loved the festival. For people who love musicals now, they're coming in and they're seeing what a 10-minute musical can be and are just as delighted.
Again, they are called the Summer Shorts, put on by City Theater. It's in its 23rd year. It's at the Arts Center. We heard from Susan Westfall, the artistic director of City Theater. Also, Tom Wall and Elizabeth Diamond, both performing in the shorts. That's coming up. It's going to be a whole month's long worth of performances, and we've got all the information on our website, WLRN.org. It's been such a pleasure. Tom, Elizabeth, Susan, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And break a leg.
Thank you.
All right, well, that's the program for this week. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great Friday. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.